From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcast from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Now, so much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please understand how grateful we are for you helping keep us on the air. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote, "The only explanation for treating religious places differently during a pandemic seems to be a judgment that what happens there just isn't as essential as what happens in secular spaces. And that is exactly the kind of discrimination that the First Amendment forbids."
Whether the question is who gets a wedding cake, who gets to keep their job, or whose religion gets special protections in a public health emergency, there are always consequences for making some rights more important than others. On this week's show, we'll examine some of those conflicts with Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance.
These are not somebody else's children. They're all our children. These children are the kite strings that lift our national ambitions aloft, and how we treat them is the measure of what kind of decency and honor we have as a society.
The culture war right in this country is targeting one of the most vulnerable populations there is, LGBT, and questioning young people. A shocking flood of state-level legislative initiatives aims at erasing the reality of transgender lives and denying the truth of their identity. The war is almost always waged in religious terms, which is why a refutation in religious terms is so critically important. And this week, a powerful tool is launching in the form of a new book titled Made Known Loved. And I'm looking forward to welcoming the author, Ross Murray, back to State of Belief Radio. But first,
and now, one of the most famous women in all of Christianity today, Beth Moore, has recently declared, "I am no longer a Southern Baptist." Main Bible study teacher said she no longer feels at home in the denomination that once saved her life.
There was some excitement a few weeks ago around the news that prominent evangelical leader Beth Moore was leaving the Southern Baptist Convention. Despite having taught millions of fervent women of faith, Moore lost an astounding amount of credibility and influence simply by challenging the immediate past president of the United States during the peak of the hashtag MeToo movement. It was a demonstration of just how politically correct followers of the famous politically incorrect 45th POTUS actually had to be. But it also sparked wider discussion of the role of women in conservative Christianity, political or not. A blunt assessment of the Beth Moore narrative appeared recently in Religion Dispatches magazine, and I am happy to welcome the author, J. Dana Trent, back to State of Belief Radio. Dana, thank you for being with us again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gaddy. It's an honor to be here.
Women leaders in evangelical Christianity are typically not very visible. Where is such ministry even possible, and what are the main problems as you see them?
Well, the main problem is something called the Baptist Faith and Message, which is a doctrine from the Southern Baptist Convention that all Southern Baptist churches adhere to. And what this doctrine does, Baptist Faith and Message of 2000, is it codifies complementarianism, which is specific gender roles for men and women with regard to household responsibilities, as well as teaching and preaching. And so any church that aligns itself with the Baptist faith and message is going to be unable, at least in theory, to assign, elect, call a female senior pastor. Therein lies the challenge for women within this tradition who long to be and are called to be and are educated to be preachers and pastors.
You know, I just have to say this. As I was listening to you say that, the definition of it, it just made me once again feel so good that I walked away from that. But pardon me for saying it. The Roman Catholic Church draws an absolute line between gender roles in ministry. So how is the situation more complicated in evangelicalism?
Well, obviously, I cannot speak strictly to the Catholic tradition because my background is Southern Baptist and then what I would call a more progressive Baptist now. But in the evangelical tradition, the gender roles extend beyond the priesthood. In other words, we're talking about a doctrine that informs the culture, that informs the household. And that's where we get into subjugation and the insidious nature of complementarianism, in that this particular doctrine, Baptist faith and message, extends beyond the church walls into the home, wherein, in heteronormative language, the male is the head of household, and females within that household are to submit to his authority. So in that way, we're talking about a doctrine, a theology, a historical construct that goes beyond Sunday. It goes beyond the walls of the church, and it affects the lives of daughters, young women, adult women, wives, sisters. It affects everyone because it's a 24/7 culture that women are living in and living under, quite frankly.
You're a Baptist clergywoman yourself, as you just said. Would you start by talking about why you initially welcomed Beth Moore's leaving the structures that she was so tightly identified with, and then felt she wasted the opportunity?
I did absolutely welcome her leaving the SBC and its monster publishing arm, Lifeway. And I say monster as in grand. I welcomed her leaving. It was definitely time for her, and I was grateful that she took that stand. But in my gut, I knew that there had to be more, and I was waiting for more. I was expecting more from more, and then came her apology last week. Now, the challenge with her apology is that while she asked for forgiveness in teaching this doctrine, in teaching complementarianism, since 1995, when she wrote her first book, I was 14, I'm 40 now, she said that she was not willing to take a strong stance on rejecting complementarianism. And I really appreciate her starting again this conversation about how intertwined and insidious the two are. Complementarianism and the Southern Baptist Convention, Southern Baptist churches, go hand in hand. So for her to take a stand in leaving the SBC, but to be unwilling to untangle herself from this very complicated historical and social construct is problematic. And it's problematic because there are women who live in households that are complementarian. And while Beth has the luxury of stepping away from it, perhaps in her own household or in her own life, there are women who do not have that privilege. Complementarianism is a very specific doctrine that identifies specific roles according to gender. Those are roles inside the church, like teaching and preaching, and roles inside the household. So they extend beyond the church into the home. In other words, at home, the male member of the household is the head of the house. He makes all of the decisions, and women in that household are under, I'm using my thumb to show, under his authority. At church, the same thing is true. According to 1 Timothy chapter 2, 12, which is the proof text, the cherry-picking scripture that complementarians use to reinforce this doctrine. And that is to say that typically, at least in the Southern Baptist tradition I grew up in, women are not allowed to teach and preach, and certainly not allowed to teach male children, usually older than 12. And so therefore that keeps women in very specific roles in churches, children's ministry, Sunday school teachers. But once there is any opportunity for what would be perceived as authority or power, the doctrine of complementarianism is used to pull away power from women and therefore their voice, quite frankly.
So what do you think it would have been more useful to hear from Beth Moore?
Great question. You know, one of the much appreciated responses that I received in conjunction with Religion Dispatch's article was that, you know, Beth Moore needs grace and time. And I really hear that. What I would have loved for her to do is to nuance her apology and to talk more about her discernment process. It would have been helpful for her to say, I'm not prepared to take a stance, and here's why. X, Y, and Z. I'm thinking through X, Y, and Z. And I would have loved for her to acknowledge her own white privilege and that she can have a toe in and a toe out of the SBC complementarianism argument. That would have been very helpful because right now, as it stands, her statement lacks nuance. It lacks premises for her argument. She did not give us evidence as to why she has not outright rejected complementarianism. And the problem with that is that by saying that she needs grace and time to discern, my response to that is that she's been writing since 1995, since I was 14. I'm 40 now. And so she's had lots of grace and time to think through this. And quite frankly, there are women who do not have time. This is an urgent, sometimes life-threatening construct for them in their own homes and churches.
Are there other evangelical women leaders who have shown the way that you're talking about, who have been more effective in their descent or departure?
Certainly. I think Jen Hatmaker has certainly made strides in this area. But my go-to example is Glennon Doyle. Glennon Doyle's marriage to Abby Womack, her extensive hard work, her nuancing of thinking through complicated doctrines. Now, Glennon Doyle is not necessarily sort of what we would call the image of the SBC when we think about that. She's not aligned with this particular tradition, but on the whole, she has many evangelical women supporters. And so her taking a hard, confident stance on these issues helps women see that it can be done and representation matters. That's why Beth Moore and this issue is so important, because there are daughters, little girls, sisters, and wives looking to her, looking to her books, her curriculum for answers to complementarianism. Mm-hmm. And that's why I would have loved for her to nuance her argument properly and thoroughly.
The dynamic that we're talking about right now must sound so antiquated to many of our listeners. And that's important because it creates a perfect breeding ground for abuse.
Yes, absolutely. The insidious nature of complementarianism is ripe for subjugation and abuse. Because if we can imagine it, you know, being a woman in your household and you are submitting to the authority of a human, another human, a male human, who may or may not be healthy, who may or may not have good psychological boundaries and mental health, who may or may not have physical abusive tendencies, you are quite frankly, exposed and vulnerable to all kinds of abuse and assault in the name of the Bible, in the name of the Bible, because the male head of the household is free to use that doctrine and proof text the Bible to support his claim that he is in charge and all women in the household and in the church should submit to him. We have seen this over and over in the SBC assault and abuse allegations. We have seen this in a smaller context within individual households where women are abused in the name of complementarianism. It is ripe, toxic for environment for abuse.
You know, more broadly, I was struck by the way Beth Moore was basically shunned after a pretty mild statement against the 45th president in the context of the hashtag MeToo movement. That level of blind followership gets people in trouble when it's applied to faith leaders, never mind a political one. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm a professor of critical thinking at Wake Tech Community College, and so my answer is always critical thinking. Folks have got to dig deep. They have to provide evidence for their claims, and they have to consider all angles of the argument. And so you're exactly right in that there was a quote-unquote blind following of Beth Moore, and she was shunned after her 2016 statements against President Trump throughout 2017 and 19, as well as her statements for hashtag Me Too. The challenge in this, of course, it led to a $1.8 million loss for Lifeway. So it was financially costly for her. But I'll go back to privilege, right? She is a woman who has resources and support and could go to the next life-giving ministry. Right now, she's partnering with Tyndale Publisher. And so as a writer, of course, I'm interested in what that trajectory will look like. But think about the women for whom, if they have statements against President Trump or they have statements against, you know, the Me Too abuse allegations, they have no support. There is tremendous fallout and no one is going to pay their bills. And so this is extremely costly for women who speak out, who do not have the safety net that she has in place.
Yeah. Going forward, I can't help but wonder if there's any hope of much of evangelical Christianity coming to terms with the corner it has painted itself into, both politically and in gender terms. Even the campaign to deny the reality of transgender identity connects to this rigid dogma of men leading and women following, because you need men and women for that power dynamic to even exist. Am I reaching too far here?
No, that is not a bridge too far. And Religion Dispatch's senior correspondent Chrissy Stroop, who writes on trans issues, has talked about evangelicals losing the grip of their narrative because of the very thing that you have just mentioned. The evangelical narrative is dependent upon this binary language and construct of gender. Without it, there is no power and authority. So of course, they want to hold on to the power and authority. And to be quite frank, white women help them do that by not denouncing complementarianism.
J. Dana Trent is an ordained Baptist clergywoman who teaches world religions at Wake Technical Community College. Her most recent book is, and I love the title, Dessert First, Preparing for Death While Savoring Life. We'll link to Dana's Religion Dispatch's article. It's titled, Dear Beth Moore, Your Apology for Complementarianism Reeks of Complementarianism, from stateofbelief.com. Dana, it's really good to have you back with us. I think every once in a while we just need to get together and talk about something. And thanks for making time to be with us again today for State of Belief Radio.
It's my honor, Dr. Gatti. Thank you so much for having me.
We're just getting started with this week's show, and you're going to want to hear all of it. Up next, Ross Murray. His new book is titled Made, Known, Loved, Developing LGBTQ Inclusive Youth Ministry. And later, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gatti. My next guest has been with us many times in his capacity as Senior Director of News and Faith Initiatives at GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. And while we've touched on his work with young LGBTQI people of faith, I'm happy to welcome Ross Murray in his role as author as he prepares for his book, Made, Known, Loved, Developing LGBTQ Inclusive Youth Ministry to Emerge on Tuesday. Ross, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back here with you.
And congratulations on this book. Let's start with the objectives. What was your goal in writing this book?
I'm a founding director of a youth ministry called The Naming Project, which is an LGBTQ-focused youth ministry. Our main program is a summer camp. And we found that we would constantly get questions from pastors and ministers and youth ministry people about how to best include LGBTQ youth into their programs. And so these questions kind of built up over time and realized the book is a good way to address the questions that were being asked, but also what are the values and assumptions that exist behind the questions as well. And so I take the questions that we have, and all the chapters are actually framed around questions, and then sort of come back with challenging answers to help people think about, what kind of congregation do we want to be? What's our values? What's very important to us? Okay, that will inform these logistical decisions about how to do impactful and meaningful and faithful ministry that does welcome and include LGBTQ youth. So it's based on 18 years at the Naming Project and now getting to proactively put that out into the world.
Who is the book for? What audiences do you imagine reading this and benefiting from it the most? I think you've just already been talking about that, so go ahead more on it.
Yeah, the primary audience is youth ministry people. I am a youth ministry person. I know you've had me on this as a guest, yes, as an advocate, right, which I am, but my work is so much youth ministry focused. And so it's for my peers, for the people that do work in congregations or summer camps, church camps, or youth ministry programs, to kind of figure out what that welcome and inclusion is like. And beyond that, I think it's going to be helpful for clergy, for pastors. I even think for parents, it's not a parenting book, but definitely Christian parents that are part of a congregation that also want their child to be safe and protected and have the opportunity to hear the gospel in the same way that all the other kids in a youth group does. I think it's going to be helpful and instructive for them. I feel like over the last 10 to 20 years, you know, there's been this ongoing raging debate about LGBTQ people in church. And one reason why I started the Naming Project and why we wrote this was that we realized all those debates were very adult in nature. It was about marriage. It was about ordination. And we weren't yet talking about what does it mean for someone who is growing up and wondering, who am I? Who did God make me to be? How do I relate to the rest of the world? And how do I grow into a healthy, productive adult? And what's really interesting is that now, when the book is coming out, we're in a setting where a lot of the debates in the public sphere has been around youth. And we have these bills in state legislatures that are specifically targeting and isolating LGBTQ youth and cutting them off from resources. So I'm hoping this will be an infusion to help churches to be those helpful resources at a time that that's being under attack.
Yeah. Made known, loved. What's the significance of those words and why is that the title?
You know, I end up landing on that title. It was one of our camp themes one year. One of our camp themes was made known, and we put it made/known. And it was really probably one of my favorite themes that we work with. And it was an exploration of the fact that we are created by God and that God knows us intimately as the way that a creator does know their own creation. And because God knows us so intimately, God loves us deeply as we are. And I think part of our role as the church and part of our role, especially for youth ministry people that are working with folks that are going through adolescence and those questions of who am I and how do I relate to God and how do I relate to the rest of the world, is really centered on making sure that they understand and know that they are made by God, that they are known by God, and that they are loved by God, which can then propel them out into the rest of the world to kind of live the rest of their lives, yeah, full and free.
Would you be able to point to an experience or two and tell something about them that you've had as a youth ministry leader that informs the made known, loved structure and content of the book?
Sure. I have a lot of stories from our time running the Naming Project, and you get a lot of stuff from there. And one year, we developed a worship ritual, and we kind of made it up. Youth ministry people know you make up a lot of stuff on the spot. So we were planning worship, and we were going to, we'll do something that incorporates the beach because worship on beach is really nice. And then my co-leaders, Brad and Jay, I was not present when they did this, but they found a mirror that was kind of laying around in a shed and decided that as a part of the ritual for this particular worship service was that I'd lead the youth in a song, but while we're singing, people were invited to kind of different stations. And the two stations that we set up were one, looking in a mirror and hearing words of affirmation from Pastor Jay. Hmm. And they would go from that mirror over to Pastor Brad, who was standing kind of ankle deep in the lake and doing a remembrance of their baptism. And so scooping up some water from the lake and making the sign of the cross in their forehead and giving them that affirmation blessing. And what's always really interesting is when we do these affirming you are God's beautiful creation, it's very hard for young people, and it's very hard for all of us to hear that and accept that. And we were a part of a television program, so I can kind of rewatch this on Our America with Lisa Ling. Youth have a very hard time making eye contact with themselves in the mirror. And you can hear gentle prodding of like, look at yourself. Don't look at me. Don't look away. Look at yourself in the mirror and hear these words of affirmation that you are a beautiful creation of God. And then moving on from there to have that affirmation be swept up in a ritual that looks and sounds like a sacrament, and helping them to remember that they are claimed by God. And I think that's true, is we kind of need that remembrance and that deep looking at ourselves and knowing the kind of beauty that we are.
I want you to talk more about the naming project, how that came into being and how it's grown to what it is.
Sure. The Naming Project is a program near and dear to my heart. So about that same time, about 20 years ago, when I was first getting started in doing some LGBTQ work, doing youth ministry, I joined the local chapter of what was then called Lutherans Concerned North America. They're now called Reconciling Works. And this was a movement to try to make the Lutheran Church more welcoming and inclusive. And I asked around a little bit, and people said at the time they had a policy against including anyone under 18 years of age. And that policy was from a fear of what accusations would come up with LGBTQ adults working and interacting with young people, which I understand the basis of the fear, and I do understand that as a real threat. But then as someone who was educated and trained in doing youth ministry work, sort of said, we can create spaces that are safe. And why don't we do that? And so advocating for them. At the same time, in my job, I was approached by a woman that asked, are there church-based programs for LGBTQ youth? And she told me the story of a young person who was growing up in suburban Minneapolis who had come out to his parents. He was 15. They were accepting, but they were trying to find a good community for him to be a part of. And they were not finding one. They were finding a lot of really secular organizations. They were finding a lot of organizations that were dealing with a lot of trauma, kids that had been kicked out of their home. And this is not this child's experience, right? And this child was looking for community, and he found community on the internet. And one day the mom came home, and there was a 40-year-old man on the front steps of their house because he had messaged and chatted with someone, and someone came over. So this like heightened that, like, we need to find something. And so this woman asked my coworker asked me, we searched and found there at the time were no such programs like that. And so decided, well, maybe we should create the first one like that. And it began as a weekly meeting on Sunday afternoons in a basement in a Lutheran church in Minneapolis. The camp grew very quickly after that and kind of has become the main program that we've done. So since 2004, non-COVID years, we've been holding a week-long LGBTQ church camp for teenagers. That if you've been to a church camp, you will recognize the structure. It looks like the camp I went to. It looks like the camp that I worked at. And the thing that makes it very LGBTQ is really the people and the intentionality on knowing that we are being a welcome and an inclusive space to help people explore their identity, their faith, their sexual orientation, their gender identity, you know, what they believe and how they're going to live that out in the real world.
Yeah. You mentioned the questions. I love how each chapter of the book is titled with a question. Could you choose one or two of these questions and just give us a taste of how you answer them?
Sure. I'm going to have to look because I don't yet have my book memorized. I probably will start getting that soon. So I think there's a couple, things that I think are really helpful to really be thinking about. One is sort of how Jesus-y should our program be? Sometimes, we set up programs and we recognize that we can either cater to folks that are very like inside our churches, inside our denominations, and they're already kind of in the flock. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, it is helpful and reaffirms their faith, but it also might limit that level of impact. And the Naming Project, since we're LGBTQ specific, we have youth that come to us from a variety of faith backgrounds, and sometimes really like no real formal faith background, a vague sense of spirituality, an agnostic, but what's interesting is that as we go through our camp program, we sort of say, you can be wherever you are on the journey. I'm not going to dictate to you what it is you have to believe. Just like I'm not going to dictate to you what kind of Christian to be, to the same way that I don't want to dictate to you what kind of LGBTQ person you need to be. But this program and the adult leaders and those of us that are running it, this is where we're coming from. These are the values that we have. This is what's important to us. And so these are the things we're going to do. We're going to sing the church songs. We're going to do worship. We're going to do prayers. And you're always invited to join us for that. And what I find is that youth are incredibly engaged and want to do that. They want to be a part of worship and the songs and the prayers and even Bible studies. And I think you get some of the best Bible study questions from youth that don't know anything about the Bible, right? Like, well, wait, why are there four different versions of the same story about Jesus? Yeah. Like, that's a great question that we don't often question or think about ourselves, but someone who's looking from the outside to ask, like, why do we have these four different perspectives on what's essentially the same story? Yeah. And then the corollary for that, I think, when we kind of get near the end, and this starts to bridge into my advocacy world as well, there's a couple questions in the last couple chapters that just say, what about working with other ministry programs that don't share my values about LGBTQ people? And what happens to LGBTQ youth outside my youth group? So that's a little bit looking beyond the congregation, yeah, looking beyond the people that are in our flock, and recognizing that if we really want to make a world where young people are seen and heard and valued and know that they're a beloved child of God, our work is going to have to go beyond our church walls. And that's going to mean, sometimes it means challenging the church structures, challenging those that are built to be anti-LGBTQ, because sadly, a lot of youth ministry comes from anti-LGBTQ sources. Mm-hmm. They're really good at what they do, but the theology isn't there. And I help people to think through, what are the questions you need to ask to these other ministries to make sure that your LGBTQ youth are going to be safe? And beyond that, how do you show up to profess the gospel and proclaim justice for LGBTQ youth, for kids that are never going to enter our churches? And so that means showing up at city council meetings or state legislatures or rallies or protests or talking about any of these dozens of bills that are targeting transgender youth this year. And so making sure that they see that as a part of their youth ministry, which traditionally is not something we've done. So I'm starting to argue that, you might think that going to a lobby day at your state capitol doesn't seem like youth ministry, really. I will argue that ski trips also aren't really youth ministry, but we do those all the time. And so this is something that you can absolutely build with a faithful lens and build it and speak out as Christians for the care and protection of the least of these, which is something that Christ calls us to do. And so I kind of give a little bit of a blueprint of like, this is how you can do that.
Yeah. And I don't have to tell you this, obviously. When we look at the religious landscape in America, an awful lot of faith leaders are ready to exclude LGBTQI+ persons, including youth. Thankfully, the number of leaders and congregations recognizing their responsibility to be welcoming is growing. And I just am guessing that that is a part of the audience that you had in mind when you were writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the beginning, and this goes back to the starting of the naming project too, those questions that came in, there were a lot of people that wanted to be welcoming and inclusive and didn't quite know how or what to do. And I tell the story about this too, a woman who I still work with and we're friends with. I was leading a panel, and this is before the naming project even started, about youth ministry for LGBTQ youth. And she said, if a child came out to me, I want to be affirming, but I don't know what to tell them. And I'm scared I'm just going to be quiet in front of them. And me not saying anything means I sound like I'm not affirming, but I really am, but I don't know. You know, it's that like fear of doing or saying the wrong thing. And I think that's part of what we need to understand and accept, and then find ways to get over or fix that. And I think that's, it's been helped in so many circles because there are increasing numbers of LGBTQ affirming congregations and people and faith leaders. But in our public, and you know this, in our public sphere, most of the loudest anti-LGBTQ voices regularly invoke religious language, regularly invoke faith. And I think we don't do that quite as much. And so I want to think about how we care for and keep our young people safe who are in our care and protection, and how we can make sure that they can be safe because they aren't always in our care and protection. And that's the public advocacy. That is, when I think of, you know, the Great Commission and the go forth and baptize all the nations, that kind of language, from this perspective, that looks like public advocacy. That looks like showing up where people are and saying, I'm here representing the Christian church and the scriptures and the God who created us all. And, a law that prevents you from getting to see your doctor does not honor you as a beautiful creation of God. And I'm here on behalf of XYZ Baptist Church, right? And to make sure that that is known and understood, one, to counter the message that's already predominantly out there, but also to start to proactively name and claim our faith in a really public way and name that as a part of what our core beliefs really are.
What would you like every person who reads that book put it down and say?
I want them to say, I have LGBTQ youth in my youth ministry, even if I don't know who they are, and I will listen to them and believe them and treat them according to what they say to me, even if they tell me something different next week or next month or next year. Those are like my two most essential kind of takeaways from the book. And then everything else kind of goes beyond there.
Ross Murray is Senior Director of News and Faith Initiatives at GLAAD, where he amplifies the voices of LGBT affirming communities of faith and LGBT people of faith. Ross is also a founder and director of the Naming Project, a faith-based camp for LGBT youth and their allies. His new book comes out on Tuesday. The title is Made Known, Loved, Developing LGBTQ Inclusive Youth Ministry. Ross, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I love chatting with you every time.
As much of the nation returns to various forms of normalcy despite the ongoing threat of COVID-19, there's a lot that's still far from normal, from the challenges of working from home to attempts to legally immunize houses of worship from any health restrictions whatsoever, even as many of those attending them refuse actual medical immunization. This pandemic, which has claimed at least 560,000 Americans, has changed things for all of us. For a look at what the road ahead may look like, I'm happy to be joined once again by my good friend, Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be here as a guest, Welton. I'm glad you're back in the saddle.
Thank you. I start with the work from home angle because I know Interfaith Alliance has been operating in this way for over a year now. What has that changed in how you do things individually and as a team?
Well, you know, we bemoan constantly when we meet every day at our inability to just interact with each other casually. We need to keep lists of what we have to talk about. We have to schedule opportunities to speak either face-to-face or on the telephone. And there is an ethos to our work that is energized by the interaction that we can have on a day-to-day basis. And that's missing. We work very hard at maintaining it. And now that almost everyone on our staff has been vaccinated, we're talking about how we might recapture some of that, at least occasionally.
Hmm. Jack, are most of our partner organizations doing something similar?
To the best of my knowledge, none of the groups we work with are back in their physical offices on a full-time basis. Some of them, like us, have had the good fortune to be able to scale back on the space that we have operated out of without giving up the benefits of having a street address and a support staff in the building and the like. Mm-hmm. But I know that a lot of them are debating now how they're going to return to a sense of normalcy whenever this pandemic and its restrictions have abated. So, yes, everybody's in the same boat.
Mm. You mentioned the lawmakers, and I wanted to talk about relationships with them. Traditionally, face-to-face engagement has been a core part of advocacy on the Hill. What is happening there?
You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and in these times, we have to be creative. The District of Columbia undertook a renovation of Union Station, the train terminal that is just off of Capitol Hill. And part of what they did was to open up the lobby and take out everything that was in there. There had been a couple of restaurants and some kiosks and stuff like that, and it's now just a large, magnificent space. Large enough, as I discovered, to ride a bicycle in, not personally, but I saw people riding bicycles around the lobby of Union Station. Now, there's a point to this story, I promise. When a group of us collected signatures in support of the Equality Act, we wanted to present them to a member of the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Chris Coons of Delaware was very gracious in being willing to accept it. We couldn't go to his office, and we couldn't meet him in close quarters. So we met with him in the lobby of in the Great Hall of Union Station while he was on his way to a train to take him back to his home in Wilmington. Hmm. So we do the best we can. I know that Katie Joseph, our policy and education director, has had a lot of meetings on Zoom and other platforms with staff members that otherwise might have been just drop-ins as we roamed Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have to tell you what, we already had to do some of this work from years and years ago when the ricin scare was on Capitol Hill, and they changed all of the mail protocols. Mm. So you can't mail a letter to Capitol Hill anymore if you wanted to get there on time. So we had to go back to older technology like fax and newer technology like email, and sometimes just dropping off a letter in a congressional office. So we're adapting to this as well.
Mm. I want to get some insights into how some special interests have been trying to leverage the pandemic to create broad religious exemptions from public health regulations. Would you talk about the work Interfaith Alliance and its partners are doing on that front?
You know, religious communities and particularly religious institutions have two very important roles to play. The first is to make clear that from a faith point of view, which is so important to so many Americans, that protecting yourself from the coronavirus by observing public health protocols and getting a vaccine is a responsibility of a faithful practitioner, because you care not only for the life with which you've been entrusted, but you care for the lives around you by making sure that you are not the agent of somebody else's misery. So for houses of worship to be out front and aggressive about that is enormously important. At the same time, a house of worship needs to model for the rest of the country, for commercial institutions, for social groups, even for families, what the wise course of action is, even in the face of essential and desirable gatherings. And we unfortunately have cohorts of people in this country, and I'm sad to say that many of them are part of faith communities, and sadder to say that many of them part of faith communities that are devout in their practice, who believe that there is or there ought to be an exemption for them gathering for spiritual purposes, for sacred purposes, as if there were some protection that came from prayer or reflection or meditation or study. There isn't. And people who believe that, and I rarely say this about any faith tradition, but people who believe that prayer is going to protect them from this virus are simply wrong.
Yeah.
And while it is absolutely correct that for the spiritual nourishment of the soul, participation in communion or in a minyan or in Juma prayers is something that is nurturing, all of those things can be compensated for in ways that being an agent of contagion cannot be compensated for. Yeah. And so we have resisted the notion that there is some special privilege that pertains to houses of worship, and have pushed back against the unfortunate statements that have come from some of our Supreme Court justices on the privileged place that religious institutions ought to have in public health considerations.
You know, we have found that a lot of leadership in the religious community doesn't mind cheapening the role of religion in public life. And we're seeing that, I'm sad to say.
It is correct. And I introduce a point of sort of personal privilege here. If anybody is watching the video of this, they see that it looks like I was picked up off the street because my hair is a mess and my beard is scruffy. I've just emerged from a period of mourning for my mother, who died 2 weeks ago. Today, the day we're taping this, would have been her 93rd birthday. But I was crucially aware of the role that my faith tradition played in supporting me through my bereavement mm-hmm. and my mourning period, even though I could not observe the traditional Shiva, the 7 days of mourning, in the way that I did for my father 30 years ago, when our house was filled from dawn to dark by hundreds of people who came to express their condolence. I was mostly alone that week, except for one or two people at a time who made appointments to come and see me. I understand that being sustained in moments of crisis, whether they're emotional or physical, is an important function of faith and of religious communities. But man, I want to be here to provide that comfort for people and to do that in a way that doesn't require a pastoral visit to a hospital.
Hmm. You mentioned the Supreme Court. That is another issue that has a lot of us concerned on the question of special rights for religious Americans tailored to the needs of particular Christian traditions. Some see Amy Coney Barrett playing a key role How closely have you been able to watch this? I know you've had many other things on mind.
I think all of the justices who came to the court under the previous administration have lived up to the concerns that we expressed when they were being vetted, nominated, and confirmed. Amy Coney Barrett is certainly one of them. Justice Neil Gorsuch is is sort of in the forefront recently of some of the decisions that have come out of the what's called the shadow docket for the Supreme Court, where he has affirmed a special place of privilege for faith communities in U.S. jurisprudence and enforcement of laws. It's not a surprise, but it is still a disappointment because the result is that I think the wonderful hope that we can protect the special place that religion has in the hearts and minds of a lot of Americans is resulting in negative impacts on people who don't share a specific set of religious beliefs that that seem to be the template for those three justices in particular.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us had concerns about the perspective that Justice Scalia brought with him to the court out of his very devout Catholicism. But he was very much an honest broker compared to what we're seeing now.
Mm. You mentioned the Equality Act. I'd just like listeners to hear a reminder from you of why an organization like the Alliance continues to make this a priority.
We get that question a lot because people want to know what your sexual orientation has to do with our emphasis on the First Amendment. And I want to remind everybody, and when you have a conversation with anybody about the Equality Act, I think it's important to introduce this point. Almost all of the objections to equality in this country as it relates to LGBTQI+ individuals comes from a religious perspective that somehow it is the divine intention that people be sexually oriented in a particular and immutable way. You will rarely hear anybody arguing from a secular point of view that there is something in secular terms that is objectionable about being homosexual or transgender or queer in any sense of the word. It always comes from that old saw that is no longer amusing, that God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And the application of certain biblical verses, mostly out of context, is what underpins groups like the Family Research Council and their allies who object to extending the same rights and privileges to Americans of differing orientation as they do to heterosexual individuals. Mm-hmm. And so it is a religious freedom issue because nobody is being denied the right to marry by the Secular Coalition of America.
Yeah.
It is the Family Research Council and groups like that that are our problem.
Jack, I don't want to forget, so I'm going to say it right now, the importance of you reminding our listeners about the web series that you're hosting, The American Purpose. Say a word or two about that to our people.
Well, if you listen to any of them, you know that I begin each one with an introduction that acknowledges the book that Henry Luce edited back in 1960, 61 years ago, called The National Purpose, in which he asked 10 white men of a certain age to talk about what the purpose of America was. There was a sense at that point, it was toward the end of the Eisenhower administration and before the Kennedy administration, that America had lost its way and that we needed to come back to something that would inspire our purpose. And not surprisingly, at that point, when communism was on the rise and people were tired from the efforts of World War II and sort of coasted through the 50s. There was a sense that God, family, work, and patriotism were the four ingredients that we needed to move forward. And they certainly were for the people who wrote, like Billy Graham and David Sarnoff and Archibald MacLeish, Adlai Stevenson. Excellent essays, all of them, but all of a kind.
Yeah.
I was just fascinated at what that volume might look like today and was very fortunate to get acceptance from a dozen people who represent a much more diverse America than that original cohort, who have talked to me about what their vision of the original American purpose was, whether it still applies today, and what our purpose ought to be going forward. And go to AmericanPurpose.org. You will see almost all of our episodes to this point posted there. We have two more that haven't been let loose on Facebook Live. They air Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, and then they're resident on our website, both interfaithalliance.org and AmericanPurpose.org. And you will hear remarkable people like Reverend Kelly Brown Douglas and Pastor Mike McBride and Wajahat Ali and Simranjit Singh. This past week, we had Whit Ayers and Stan Greenberg together, the preeminent Republican and Democratic pollsters, respectively, talking about what they know of the years of study of the American public. And we kicked off the series with Senator Tammy Baldwin, and we're concluding it with Senator Chris Coons, both of whom were remarkable. Yeah. I am so energized by this, Welton, I can't tell you, and I'm looking forward to doing a second season starting sometime late in the summer, I think.
Good. That's very good. Well, I know you can't be really sure that you can answer this question, but what do you think will be the heavy major kinds of things that you will be doing in the months ahead? Is it one thing? Is it a lot of things? What do you think?
I don't want people to think that we're sort of treading the same ground over and over again, even though a lot of what we talk about is what we've been talking about through the previous administration and even before that. But with Congress configured the way it is, which is both a positive and a negative, many of the legislative initiatives about hate crimes, about travel accessibility, about healthcare, and certainly about equality issues, especially as it relates to marriage and adoption, are not just sort of pie in the sky aspirations now. There is legislation that will pass the House, I think, pretty easily, but will be a much heavier lift in the Senate because of the very narrow majority that our side holds on a lot of these issues. So that's where a lot of our efforts are going to be. I would remind people that what we're doing now is debating actual legislation because we have leadership that is allowing these debates to come to the floor of the Senate, whereas before they were being frustrated, sometimes even before they got to committee. And so we are working very hard to talk to anybody who will listen to us on Capitol Hill about the importance of an honest exchange that results in a legislative referendum. And what happens over the next 18 months in Congress will have a huge impact on what Congress and the Senate will look like in the second 2 years of the Biden administration and what that will mean for these kinds of religious freedom issues and other issues as well. So that's what we're focused on. And my hope is that we'll be successful. And of course, you know, there are perennial issues. You will, I'm sure, be talking about the National Day of Prayer and Meditation, which is coming up next month. We've already initiated talks with the administration on how that can be promoted appropriately in a country that constitutionally is not supposed to take a stand on the establishment of religion, and what that means both in terms of supporting the population and supporting the laws that govern them. So we're working on all of that stuff as well.
Well, let me finish with a question that can be answered with absoluteness. Interfaith Alliance needs members, supporters, money, activists. We need people like the people who listen to this show. And I can't let you go without saying how important it is that all of that comes together around Interfaith Alliance and your leadership.
Well, thanks. Well, you've already said it. So let me suggest, as you do at the end of every episode, you suggest that people share what they've heard that they've liked with a friend and bring somebody else into the family that listens to State of Belief each week. I've had, interestingly enough, three calls just in the past couple of weeks, and I wasn't around much the last few weeks, from groups in different cities that would like to affiliate in some way with Interfaith Alliance. There is strength in numbers, and there is a great possibility for us to have an impact, not just nationally, but at least as importantly on a state and local level, if like-minded people will come together and just focus on one or two religious freedom issues that will keep these matters at the top of mind for state and local legislators. Retail politics at the local level is much more accessible than Capitol Hill, even now that they're taking down some of the fences. And we have the resources to help people achieve and accomplish what they need in order to live a life of integrity under the provisions of the national constitution and their state constitutions. So in addition to all those things, money, membership, calling your representatives, all those kinds of things, find a few friends. They don't have to be clergy. They don't even have to be religiously active on a regular basis. They just need to be concerned about these issues, and we'll support you in forming the Interfaith Alliance of Podunkville. We'd be happy to do it.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, defending true religious freedom for all. A great man, a great friend. Jack, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, as I say every time, it is always a great pleasure to have a conversation with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, a person whom you think this might be helpful for. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.